Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the NGS J6 and JK opening meeting. At this time, all lines have been placed in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the session, you will need to press star one on your telephone. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Carolyn Cunningham. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Felicia. Welcome, everybody that's here in person and also everyone that's on the phone. We had a little bit of delay, and we have a full agenda, so we'll sort of march right on. Nikita, could we go to the next slide? Dr. Aladelli is here. Dr. Bourne is on the phone. Dr. Durden is here, and Craig Howe is here. We don't have Dr. McKinney listed, but he's here with us too. Craig, do you have anything you want to say?
My name's not on there on purpose. I'm trying to be incognito. No, but welcome, everyone. Just a few technical things. If you're a speaker, we're going to ask that you come to the podium. There is a spider or an octopus or tentacle, whatever term you want to, mic at the podium, and then your slides will be projected. So if you'll come to the podium, then the phone participants can hear you actually fairly well. I want to welcome you again. As you know, this year has been sort of a change for us for the LCD development process. It's been a year of learning. CMS has changed the direction that we go in for developing our LCD. So I think we've acclimated well. We'll see what next year holds. And without further ado, we'll turn it back to Carolyn for us to get rolling on our topics for today. So thank you for your attendance.
Thanks, Craig. Okay. Steve, we're glad you were able to join us. Let's start off with the first policy, select minimally invasive GERD procedures.
Operator, could you open up Steve Bourne's line, please?
I'm not showing his line connected at this. Yes, it's connected. His line is open.
Okay. Steve, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, we can. Can you hear in the back? Okay. We're ready, Steve.
Now we can do.
Operator, we're not hearing Dr. Bourne.
His line is open on our end. He may have it muted on his end.
Okay. Let me just get a little closer to the screen. Okay. The first one is the select minimum invasive GERD procedure, DL35080. This is really a reconsideration of the current policy. Based on the new CMS regulations, we have to treat this like a new policy. So we do have some presentations, correct?
We do.
Okay. We have the first one, please.
You're talking about slides?
Yes.
Okay.
We have them. Okay. Here we go. And this is particularly, we're talking about LINX and the reflex management system, and people can read. Clinical data from the various studies are emerging. At this time, open-label studies of patient registries with short-term follow-ups are the dominant source of data. The overwhelming preponderance of reviewers remain equivocal to support and have called for randomized controlled trials for clinical follow-up, long-term follow-up. And in the absence of such studies and the absence of wide acceptance, endoscopic treatments for GERD, in this case, are not proven effective. This is not really a true. It's different than these other ones, but it's not proven effective. And we have the analysis of the evidence. and the number of papers. And we saw the SAGE Technical and Value Assessment Committee's paper, which we know is the this is the lowest form of evidence. And in summary, there were concerns about the quality of evidence, including randomization, the above-mentioned likely patient overlap in three studies, and the concern of long-term efficacy and safety. Thus, the submitted medical evidence does not support a level to support the change of this contractor's non-coverage policy.
Thanks, Steve.
You're
Dr.
Welcome.
Holt is with us. He's coming to the front so he can have a microphone.
Thanks. Right, mic right here.
Yep.
Okay. Great. Can everybody hear me okay? All right, thank you.
Yes,
I'll try and keep this to my 10 minutes or less. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you all today about magnetic sphincter augmentation therapy. I'm a surgeon from Wisconsin at the Medical College, and I'd like to share with you a little bit of information about why I'm passionate that we should be able to offer this to our Medicare beneficiaries. Next slide, please. So who gets reflux? It turns out that Medicare beneficiaries get it, just like a lot of other folks. GERD is a really common condition, as everybody knows. 20% of the United States population has reflux. Hospitalizations related to this condition have increased dramatically in the last few years, more than 200% over an eight-year interval. We know that the incidence of reflux increases rapidly as people age. In fact, in 2004, more than a quarter of Medicare beneficiaries were using GERD medications, and this accounted for nearly $6 billion at the time. Next slide, please. So reflux disease is inherently a mechanical disease. And so the physiology is the lower esophageal sphincter fails in this condition, and the lower esophageal sphincter either becomes too weak, too short, or not enough of it remains in the abdominal cavity. It may migrate above the hiatus into the chest, which is a hiatal hernia. And in this context, with any of these three or a combination of these three factors that lead to the sphincter failing, in a patient after they eat, when they bend over, when they strain, these two variables can combine to overcome the sphincter and lead to abnormal reflux of acid, digestive enzymes, and bile. And this is an important point. We have medical therapy for the acid component of it. We don't have a treatment for the rest of what reflux is. If you could forward to the next slide. And so there's a critical need for a treatment for reflux disease that functions differently than medical therapy, which is our main stage first-line treatment. So we have 21 million patients in this country on proton pump inhibitors, and we know that up to 40% of these patients are still having symptoms that persist or break through medical therapy. We know that medical therapy does not stop reflux because of what I shared before. This is a mechanical problem. It's a failure of the sphincter. And so these patients who are on acid reduction therapy continue to have reflux. By having them take these medications, we've changed the character of reflux so it's less acidic, but reflux continues to the same degree. So there's digestive enzymes, bile, recently ingested food in the refluxate. We're really not addressing the root cause of the problem with medical therapy. Next slide. So the Nissen fundoplication is current treatment options. It's been around for a long time. The goal of a Nissen is to improve the sphincter function in a patient whose sphincter has failed. It's a reconstruction. You completely take apart the anatomy. You wrap the fundus of the stomach around the esophagus. You're doing a permanent procedure. You're using the fundus to do this reconstruction. The fact of the matter is that there's a ton of variation in technique. There is not a standardized technique for the Nissen fundoplication. Everybody does it differently. I'm a foregut surgeon. My practice is almost 100% focused on GERD. A massive portion of my practice is fixing failed fundoplications. I always get the op notes and review them, and no one has ever done a fundoplication like the person before them. There's tons of variability. This leads to tons of variability in outcomes. We know that the fundoplication can lead to gas bloat, inability to belch, difficulty vomiting, difficulty swallowing. We also know that less than 1% of patients who would otherwise qualify for anti-reflux surgery actually choose to pursue it because this is the most commonly offered option. Next slide. The Nissen fundal placation fails. As many as 15% of patients who have a Nissen ultimately undergo a reoperation, and the cumulative failure rate is about 1 out of 4. We know from the pattern of failure that about 2/3 of the failures that occur happen in the first 2 years. We're just not seeing the same pattern or timing or rate of failure with the magnetic sphincter augmentation device that we see with the Nissen. Next slide. So the Lynx reflux management system, it augments the lower esophageal sphincter with this device that's implanted. It preserves the ability to belch and vomit while reducing regurgitation symptoms. The magnetic beads attract each other, and it precisely augments the lower esophageal sphincter that has failed. So there's two parts to the procedure. One is reestablishing that junction between the esophagus and the stomach back into the abdominal cavity, so reducing a hiatal hernia, and then augmenting the pressure of the sphincter. And when I say it precisely augments the sphincter, I mean that because the magnets attract each other at a pressure that's equivalent to the force of a normal lower esophageal sphincter. So this is a much more physiologic reconstruction of that valve than a Nissen is. The Nissen is a super valve. That's where these symptoms come from. It's a supra physiologic reconstruction, and the Lynx is much more physiologic. Next slide, please. So a couple fallacies and unfair comparisons that have been out there. The Lynx is not a lap band. It's fundamentally different. The lap band is an obesity procedure. The band is placed around the stomach, so there are acid-producing parietal cells above the band. The band is high pressure. It's intended to be high pressure, and it's intended to lead to satiety and restriction for the patient. You can see the band on the left in comparison to the magnetic sphincter augmentation device. Lap bands have gone in and more often come out now. There's a lot of failures with these. These are weight loss failures. It's a fundamentally different operation, and it's not a fair comparison. The Angel Chick is a reflux device that was used decades ago. You can see the Angel Chick on the right. It's a very big device. It's a very heavy piece of silicone. The Angel Chick actually worked for reflux. The problem is that it would migrate. This is a much smaller profile, and we do not see migrations following the Lynx like we did for the Angel Chick. Next slide, please. There have been quite a few studies published in the literature. There have been 2 randomized controlled trials, 3 meta-analyses, 14 single-arm studies, 8 comparative studies published on magnetic sphincter augmentation. You can see the timeline. Next slide, please. Magnetic sphincter augmentation has been established to be safe. There's more than 16,000 devices that have been implanted worldwide, and you can see the follow-up on thousands of patients, where we see that the explant rate is in the neighborhood of 2 to 3%. The erosion rate is very low at a fraction of a percent, about 0.1%, and there have been no mortalities attributed to the Lynx itself. Next slide, please. When we talk about erosion specifically, we know that erosions happen early, and again, this is data from more than 16,000 patients. Most of the erosions occur between 1 and 4 years at an average of about 2.5 years. Erosions happen gradually, and they're easily handled with either completely endoscopic removal of the device or a combination of laparoscopy and endoscopy. These are not sick patients. This can be done on a scheduled basis. Next slide, please. We know that the magnetic sphincter augmentation is effective and durable. Here's 5-year data looking at the Lynx. This is published data. We know that patients have durable relief of their heartburn and their regurgitation. We know that they're able to stay off of their proton pump inhibitors, and we know that they're satisfied at 5 years and beyond. We have physiologic data to support that, pH studies at these intervals. We have better data on the magnetic sphincter augmentation device than we do on the current standard, which is Nissen fundal placation. Next slide, please. Some Medicare-specific data. Next slide. There aren't a lot of studies conducted specifically in Medicare cohorts, but this is from the New England Journal article that was published as part of the pre-market study. We know that the patients that were 65 years and older in this cohort, they preserved their ability to belch. Next slide. They preserved their ability to vomit just like other patients in the study, and they experienced the same symptomatic outcomes, the same improvement in their quality of life. Next slide. This is from a randomized controlled trial showing that regurgitation is addressed by a magnetic strength augmentation device significantly more effectively than we see with proton pump inhibitor therapy. This is a randomized controlled trial comparing PPIs at a double dose to magnetic sphincter augmentation. Next slide, please. With 1 year follow-up. A randomized trial of the magnetic sphincter augmentation device versus the Nissen is not feasible. The Nissen fundoplication is a non-reversible surgical procedure. The fundus is not spared. It's a significant procedure where we do a reconstruction. It would be difficult to randomize patients. Patients don't want Nissen fundoplication. Less than 1% of patients who would benefit from it are willing to do it. We don't believe that clinical equipoise is possible in a study like that. As I mentioned earlier, there's a ton of variability in Nissen fundoplication. It is as much art as it is science, and deciding what the optimal technique and standardizing that is difficult. There are two studies out there that use propensity scoring techniques to compare Nissen versus Lynx. Next slide. And in these studies, which included 114 and 50 patients, we know when we compare Lynx to Nissen that improvement in GERD HRQL scores happened and that the side effect profile was very different. So patients who had MSA had less difficulty belching and less vomiting than following Nissen, and they experienced similar improvements in GERD-related quality of life. We know that they have less regurgitation in other comparative studies, that they stay in the hospital for a shorter length of time, and they're able to stay off their PPI long term. Next slide, please. So in summary, I believe that the data supports the fact that MSA is safe, effective, and durable. The side effect profile compares very favorably to a fundoplication. I see this in my practice. I would much rather place a magnetic sphincter augmentation device in a patient or have one. A lot of surgeons who have reflux ultimately opt for the Lynx as opposed to a fundoplication. It is a simple procedure. It can be standardized. I think this is an important option for our patients on long-term proton pump inhibitors who have complications or persistent symptoms related to reflux on these medical therapies. Less than 1% of candidates opt for surgery due to limitations, as I described, and for those 30 to 40% of patients with poorly controlled reflux on proton pump inhibitors, this results in really high healthcare utilization and long-term health consequences. Our patients are kicking the can down the road. They're not willing to have a Nissen. They want something else. This is something that can fill the gap. I have a list of patients with reflux disease who have Medicare who are just waiting for this to be an option for them. And they're informed patients. One of my patients on my list is a gastroenterologist himself. One of my patients is married to a gastroenterologist. I would like to be able to offer them what I consider to be a better option. And I think we need to be able to offer this to our Medicare beneficiaries in Wisconsin and beyond. So,
thank you. Thank you, Dr. Gold. Questions or comments for Dr. Gold here in the room? On the phone?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you would need to press star 1 on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster. There are no questions at this time.
Thank you, Felicia. Thank you, Dr. Gold.
Thank you.
Next, we have Dr. Carillas from Northwestern. He's here and needs to go to clinic soon, right?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Is there any way I can advance the slides?
No, because it's not from here, sorry.
Right, could you bring my slides up, please? Could you bring my slides up, please?
Nikita, we need to go to the next presentation.
Yes, I'm trying. One moment.
So good afternoon. I'm a gastroenterologist, not a surgeon. I worked at Northwestern for a long time, and I've had a peculiar interest in reflux disease for most of that time. Slide. So just advance through this to the bottom, and these are medical data on treating reflux disease with proton pump inhibitors. They made their reputation on healing esophagitis, and you can see there, the number needed to treat is very small to see healing. But when you get to symptoms, it gets less and less effective. And the last ad here is regurgitation. Go ahead and put that in, please. When it gets to regurgitation, the efficacy of proton pump inhibitors is poor because what they do is they take the acid out, they don't stop reflux. Slide. And advance that one more. So if you look at real indications for non-medical treatment, it's these. And high on the list is regurgitation-dominant reflux disease. The others are less important for today's argument. But the problem of esophagitis was solved with the PPIs. It's persistent symptoms that we deal with now. Slide. Dr. Gould just went over this operation. This is the standard. So this is what now gets offered to people who need non-medical treatment. It's a Nissen fundoplication. There is a lot of variability. It's a complicated operation, and it is prone to problems. Slide. We talk about randomized controlled trials. This is the randomized controlled trial for fundoplication. One. Published not that long ago, in 2011. Now, the primary outcome here was healing esophagitis and resolving heartburn. A secondary outcome was acid regurgitation, and you can see that there is some improvement in acid regurgitation for fundoplication versus the comparator, which was esomeprazole in this trial. So, yes, surgical therapies are more effective for regurgitation. Slide. But they have side effects. Dysphagia would be one, and here you can see the comparison between the PPI group and the fundoplication in postoperative dysphagia. Slide. Even more impressive is gas bloat, or inability to belch, inability to vomit, all of these things. There's very clear separation because, as Dr. Gould pointed out, this is an overcompensation for a defective sphincter, so it limits the outflow from the stomach even when it is desirable. Slide. The reason for that is because the stomach, not only do you have a supercompetent valve, but it loses its ability to accommodate. Normally, when you eat, the stomach gets bigger. When you take the fundoplication and tie it in a knot, tie a knot around the esophagus, you take away the fundus, you potentially damage the vagus nerve, and you lose the ability to accommodate, so you get these dyspeptic symptoms. Slide. And just build all the way through this. This is a study from Mayo Jacksonville looking at an in-house group of fundoplication patients. There's another side to that. Go ahead. Preoperative and postoperative. And focus on the big 73% preoperative, no bowel dysfunction, and what happens to them after the fundoplication. Diarrhea, bloating, abdominal pain, constipation, half of them became IBS patients, basically. Slide. Slide, please. I know this is a good one, but slide, please. And then there is the issue of more serious outcomes from fundoplication. These are studies, population-based studies, that looked at the long-term outcome and complications from fundoplication. Here's one that gets everybody's attention, death. And in the U.S. cohorts, so this is like the VA, Washington database, all of that, death rates from fundoplication, 0.8%, 0.4%, 0.8%. That's pushing 1%. Next slide. And then there are life-threatening complications in the same cohorts, 2%, 3.4%, 2%. This is not a benign operation. It's real surgery, and you have real adverse events here. Slide. So the problems with fundoplication are these: complications, breakdown, and secondary symptoms. Slide. These are a list of procedural treatments for GERD that have been proposed and developed to some degree since. We're going to focus on the links. slide. This is what it looks like intraoperatively. It's this little necklace of magnetic beads placed around the gastroesophageal junction. Slide. And this was the first significant publication showing its efficacy. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a 100-patient series. There was no control, so it was not a randomized controlled trial, but they had a physiological outcome, which was the control of acid reflux. Slide. And there it is. So that's the control of acid reflux at 1 year. You went from 10.9% esophageal acid exposure to 3.3%. Normal is anything under about 5%. So you basically normalized acid exposure time in the esophagus. Slide. You saw this already, but it's the five-year outcome of that same cohort of patients. Focus on the regurgitation, which is the red line. It goes down like a stone, and it stays down for 5 years. Slide. This is a trial comparing magnetic sphincter augmentation to double-dose proton pump inhibitors. So patients had failed single-dose PPI, and you have the options of either doing something else with this MSA or doubling the dose of PPI, which is common practice. Slide. And this is the outcome of that trial in terms of eliminating severe regurgitation. 90% on one side and 10% on the other side. Slide. And looking at the breakdown in regurgitation, here you can see a very profound difference between the MSA on the left and the twice daily PPI on the right. You basically got rid of regurgitation in 80% and reduced it in the rest. Slide. Other outcomes, improved quality of life, satisfaction with current condition, equally discrepant between the two groups. So there weren't any adverse side effects coming in that were compromising quality of life. Slide. You saw this data on safety, but in terms of explants, you're looking at about 2 to 4%. Device removal, and this was from thorax, so this was overall about a 4,000 implant experience. When you remove the Lynx device, you remove the Lynx device and the person is the same as they were before. It's not like a fundal plication where subsequent operations introduce yet more morbidities. Slide. So if I were to look at this, you can advance one here. In terms of the attributes of the MSA device, it's conceptually valid, very obvious what it does. There's a physiological proof of principle. There's demonstrated symptom reduction both in controlled and uncontrolled trials. There's demonstrated pH control both in controlled and uncontrolled trials. The safety data is acceptable. The only thing that wide acceptance depends upon at this point is third-party reimbursement, and I would advocate for that. I think that's the end slide. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Dr. Bourne here. I didn't see in any of your slides any conflict of interest statement.
Sorry for omitting it, but I don't have any.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. To withdraw your question, press the pound key.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Mesh?
Thank you for letting me speak today. I'm a thoracic and foregut surgeon in the Northwestern system, And I specifically trained with one of the individuals who masterminded this device. And there is no way that this device would have come as far as it had if it hadn't been scientifically sound. Many of the people involved in this device, creation of this device, are super aggressive scientists, not just clinicians. And although I'm not a scientist anymore, I'm just a clinician, I can speak from the clinical side of things, and that's what I intend to do today. I will present a little bit more of the science, but many of my colleagues have already done that. There are couple things I want to say before I take a look at my slides. The first thing is with respect to the comments that were made in the first part of this talk today, and that is this is not something that is emerging. This is something that has been now around, and the data is supporting, not just emerging the support of, and I implore you to take a look at the data closely to convince yourselves of the same things, that the science is now here to support what we want to do. The second thing is this is not an endoscopic procedure. This is a laparoscopic procedure, so it is clinically the same as doing a laparoscopic misinfundoplication in terms of the approach, the surgical approach. From that standpoint, it is something that's done by surgeons, not by gastroenterologists, who are here supporting our efforts today. Lastly, it has already been adopted by Medicare organizations in other parts of the United States. So in those areas, we have Medicare patients that already can be offered more than just the singular Nissen fundoplication, that the Medicare patients who are paying the same dollar per dollar are not currently being offered support for this device. So I think it's something that needs to be overturned and supported in our region. The summary of the evidence for the MSA is, again, it's already here, and it's not something that I think we need to continue to nitpick at the early beginnings. We're going to continue to study it, obviously, but already we've been able to demonstrate the safety, the efficacy, and the long-term data already out to 5 years. If you look at the failures in the Nissen fundoplication group, that failure is usually before 5 years anyway. So looking at a five-year cohort is about all we really need to do to get things rolling. Next slide. We already talked briefly about the eligibility, but again, this is an area where overall the aggressive approach to reflux disease is underutilized. A significant number of patients suffer from reflux, but not everybody needs surgical intervention. And the gastroenterologists funnel people to the surgeons only after they've passed a certain number of clinical tests to say you're a failure on medical therapy. The biggest cohort, of course, is the regurgitation patients, but not only those patients. Many patients with double-dose PPIs that are failing with no particular regurgitative content still need to be considered for anti-reflux surgery. Next slide. We can see that, again, showing that there's a very large cohort of patients that don't really get addressed properly. They're offered only medical therapy. But if we have a more suitable surgical option, more people would be able to get relief from their disease. Next slide. So, next slide. Here you can see how the device works. Again, it applies a minimum pressure of 15 millimeters of mercury around the lower esophageal sphincter, which is the physiologic pressure that the rest of us get to enjoy throughout our lives. This device allows the restoration, the exact amount of pressure, because it is very carefully measured and implanted. So it's a very reproducible procedure. The removal is also very easy and leaves you back into the normal anatomy that you had before you went in for the operation. And you can usually, the length of stay is shorter and you resume your activities much, much more quickly. So it's something that offers return to work and return to usual activities much quicker. Next slide. We talked quite a bit already about the alternative to the Nissen fundoplication, but I kind of want to go through the things that I think are important for you to consider as you're considering this data. Next paragraph, or next slide. Next slide. So we know that it's at least equal to the Nissen fundoplication in terms of the outcomes. So the durability, you can see here, the long-term durability seems to be at least as good as a Nissen fundoplication. Next slide. It has incredible control over regurgitation. It seems to stay down over the longer period of time. Next slide. It also helps to keep most patients off of their PPI therapy. And I would add to that that patients that go back on any PPI therapy after a Nissen fundoplication generally go back on and never come back off, whereas with the LINC system, what I've noticed in my practice and many other people around the country that I work with in this device have noticed that it's intermittent dosing, not necessarily going back on for a forever period of time. Next slide. The quality of life is considerable. I'd like to share with you a brief story about a husband and wife team. The husband had had a Nissen fundoplication 10 years ago. He had urged his wife to come in and have, to have the same thing done alongside of him several years ago, and she refused when she heard about the LINC. She came to see me, and I put her LINC in, and she had a really good result, which is very common. The husband started having a recurrence, opted to have his Nissen taken down and the LINC put in. It's not uncommon that you see people that are coming back with recurrences from the Nissen opting to have the LINC put in as opposed to have a redo of their Nissen. Next slide. Next slide. So here is some of the data that you've seen already, just to kind of briefly push on the points that I think are really important. A lot of people are worried about not being able to burp or throw up. I don't personally know why that would be a problem, but a lot of people want to be able to do that. This device allows for physiologic regurgitation, belching, and vomiting. Next slide. We already talked about, just in general, how it improves patients' HRQL scores. Next slide. Similar to the Nissen fundoplication, the regurgitation is much better with the LINC, and this is something that stays for the duration. Next slide. We haven't talked yet about what about the operating time. Well, I can tell you that doing a Nissen fundoplication, if you do it the way that you're trained, takes a lot longer than putting in a LINC. It requires mobilization of the anatomy, which is often already abnormal. It requires placing the anatomy into an abnormal supraphysiologic state, something that the body doesn't really want, and it takes quite a bit longer to do, even in the hands of people who do it all the time. The LINC is a very quick, very easy device to insert, and it's very precise in terms of how the measurements are done. Next slide. The reoperation rates, as we have discussed before, are also very low with the LINC compared to Nissen fundoplication. But the beauty is that if you have to remove a LINC, you remove it and your anatomy is normal. If you have to undo a Nissen fundoplication, you often end up with holes in the esophagus, holes in the stomach, feeding tubes for 2 months, stents, leaks, ICU stays, ventilators, the whole bit. It's a much more difficult second time through procedure to do if you have a reoperation after a Nissen fundoplication. Next slide. Significant shorter length of stay. Almost all of my patients will go home on the same day after a LINC. After a Nissen, because it takes a longer time to do it, you're more than likely going to admit people, especially the elderly population, the Medicare population that we're specifically talking about. Next paragraph. Next slide. It hasn't yet been totally evaluated, but we do expect that the 30-day readmission rate is going to be very low. I mean, I can speak with many of the people that I work with around the country. Very few of us have had any readmissions from the LINC. Readmission from a Nissen fundoplication, also not very common, but not zero. Next slide. So I would just say in closing that, surgically, this is something that's much easier to provide, to place, and it provides relief. And when patients come in to see you postoperatively, they're much, much happier with their result. And I think it's really critical that we're able to offer to our Medicare population here the same thing that other Medicare patients around the country are already getting the benefit of. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Again, Dr. Bourne, one question. I did not see a slide with any potential conflict of interest. Is
yeah, I have.
That you report?
No conflicts to disclose.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the line?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone.
To withdraw your question, press the pound key.
Right?
Dr. Altamare?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Tony Altamare. I'm a general surgeon out in the western suburbs of Chicagoland, Central DuPage Hospital, which is out in DuPage County. We've heard a lot of data this morning spoken. I don't feel any need to repeat that. And what I wanted to talk to you this morning is about my clinical experience as a 35-year experienced general surgeon who has been doing anti-reflux surgery since the early 90s. The evolution of reflux surgery is fascinating, I think. Dr. Nissen performed the first Nissen fundoplication in 1955. So there's a huge amount of data and an understanding of what that procedure is. I wasn't alive then, although I feel like I could be. My experience was back in the 80s, I trained at Loyola. I came out and practiced in 1988 to the Central DuPage Hospital in Winfield, Illinois. And in 1992, the first laparoscopic cholecystectomy was performed, and that exploded this area of laparoscopic surgery. Very quickly then, the Nissen fundoplication was adopted as a procedure that could be done laparoscopically. And I want to echo what the previous speaker said. This is not an endoscopic procedure. This is a laparoscopic procedure. And I noticed in the slide, the first slide that was presented on why this was turned down is that it was felt to be an endoscopic procedure. This is not an endoscopic procedure. This is a laparoscopic procedure. In the early 90s, mid-90s, late 90s, this procedure, the laparoscopic Nissen fundoplication, exploded. We were doing anywhere from 100 to 200, sometimes 250 a year, which is 4 to 5 a week in my practice. And it became a standard way to treat surgically this difficult-to-manage medical problem, and patients latched onto it. What happened, though, is that as this procedure was adopted, there was such a variability in the results. There was such a variability in the success of the operation, such a variability in the number of complications that occurred, that slowly the gastroenterologists and patients decided, I'm not sure this is for me. And all the reasons why has been described. It's a operation that distorts the anatomy. It's an operation that is not easily duplicated from surgeon to surgeon. Again, Dr. Nissen, this concept of wrapping the top of the stomach around the bottom of the esophagus was brilliant. What a brilliant idea this was. And so he deserves a ton of credit for this. As this has evolved then in my practice in the 90s and the early 2000s, I was, as a reflux surgeon, doing tons of these. Like I said, anywhere from 50 to 200 in a year. And then slowly that practice slowed down because of the variability in the results. About 5 years ago, the Lynx device came along to the community surgeon. Again, I'm a community surgeon, not a researcher, as an alternative to the Nissen fundoplication. And the attractiveness there is that it is reproducible. And as described, it is a relatively simple operation that is done very quickly. And so what I've experienced in my patient population, I'm back to doing anywhere from 50 to 100 anti-reflux procedures in a year. I've adopted Lynx as an adjunct to that, and I find a lot of people request the Lynx once they hear the data. And the common statement I get made to me from these patients who've had successful anti-reflux procedure, i.e. the Lynx device, is thank you for giving me my life back, because we cannot underestimate the significant lifestyle changes that occur in someone with chronic reflux disease. And so to offer a cure for this, and that's really what this is a cure for reflux disease. All the other approaches are just Band-Aids or masking of the acid. This is a true cure for reflux disease, has been a remarkable addition to my practice. So we, out in the western suburbs, we do a lot of community outreach. We do a lot of community education. And about once a month for the last several years, I've been doing a community outreach, a dinner with the docs, where we invite community members to come hear about topics, and reflux is one that I present frequently. Now, albeit a lot of people show up, and most commonly the Medicare population shows up, and I think it's because we offer a free meal. I think that's the main reason. But I hope that there's other reasons why they do that. And after a presentation, I get a huge excitement from the Medicare population and we track these patients and we bring them in and we bring them in for consultation. And it is very disappointing to not be able to offer this to the Medicare population because it can't be paid for. And so that's why I'm here today to reiterate the fact that this is great technology. The data is proven. And again, I don't feel I had to present any more of the same slides on the good data that's surrounding this. But we need an opportunity to offer this to our patients and the Medicare population that would really benefit from this. I think that's all I have to say. I would add that I have nothing to disclose. I'm a community surgeon who just works for a living.